Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and political columnist George Will is our next guest. As some of you know, the man who plays right field in the political arena also loves baseball, and he is re-releasing his classic baseball book from 20 years ago called Men at Work, The Craft of Baseball. As you might expect from George Will, this is baseball for brainiacs who want serious analytical detail with their home run trots. To that end, the book is written in four sections, focusing on the four major skills with four baseball greats: on hitting with Tony Gwynn, pitching with Oral Hershiser, managing with Tony La Russa, and fielding with Cal Ripken Jr. It also has a new introduction for the new edition, which references, among other things, Will's work on the Commissioner's Initiative on Baseball in the 21st Century, with other eminences including Paul Volcker and George Mitchell. So we'll talk some politics and some baseball with George Will. George, thanks so much for doing this. Nice to have you back on WNYC.
Glad to be with you.
So let's start with baseball. And why The Craft of Baseball as your subtitle, rather than the art or the science or anything else?
Well, this is an anti-romantic view of baseball. You know, usually when I write a book, and I've written 13 of them, the title is hardest and comes last. I had the title before I had anything else in this book. I didn't want boys of summer, not boys of anything. These are men doing a dangerous, exacting, demanding business. The craft is an attempt to say it's not art, it's not poetry. It's like making shoes. It's like making poetry. It's like doing lots of things. It requires a technique, and the technique is inherently interesting. And once you understand it, your enjoyment of the game goes up. You know, if you go to an art gallery, it's nice to have a docent. Well, I wanted, and I got these four guys, La Russa, Gwynn, Hershiser, and Ripken, to be docents for me, to show me around the gallery of baseball.
Pretty good docents, not to mention high paid. So let's take an example. Give me any example that you want from your Cal Ripken chapter. And I'm thinking of it this way. New Yorkers might watch Derek Jeter or Jose Reyes play shortstop and not think of picking up the ball and throwing it to first as something that takes a lot of thinking or a lot of shoemaker's craft. What can we look for at shortstop that we might be overlooking as fans?
Well, picking up the ball and throwing it to first is the least of the matter. The point is to be where the ball is going. And that's why baseball is about anticipation. And it's about anticipation based on the enormous sediment of data that is produced by a game of episodes, pitch by pitch, inning by inning, 162 games, more than 1,400 innings a year. Jeter knows where the ball's going because he knows two things. He knows what his pitcher's going to throw. He does that because he can see into the plate and see what pitch is being called. He knows if his pitcher, say it's Mariano Rivera, he knows he can execute this pitch. When Yankee fans see Jeter with a runner on first playing shortstop and he puts his glove up to his mouth, he's giving a signal to the second baseman what pitch is coming, breaking ball or fastball. So the second baseman too can anticipate how the batter might handle this. If it's a fastball, he's less apt to be able to pull it. You position yourself accordingly. So as I say, picking it up and throwing, it's the easy part. It's being where the ball is going in advance. It's the anticipation. It's the art and the craft.
George Will, my guest on WNYC, his book about baseball, Men at Work, The Craft of Baseball, just re-released. And a lot has changed, a lot hasn't changed about baseball since you first wrote the book 20 years ago. What changed, other than steroids, or maybe a few changes, are among the most striking to you?
The way we think about the game, it's been a cliche for centuries, really, it seems, that baseball doesn't have a clock, which is true. On the other hand, it's useful to think about baseball as having a clock that has 27 ticks. They're outs. 27th tick, the game's over. The trick, on the one hand, if you're on offense, is to avoid making an out. Avoid making a tick. That's why, with the new emphasis on on-base percentage, you understand that a walk really is as good as a hit. Keep the inning going. And on defense, which is the new emphasis in baseball now, The more you can catch the ball, the more your pitcher can pitch to contact. Doesn't have to feel he has to blow the batter away. He can let the ball go in play because you're good at catching the ball. And that's why in the post-steroid era, baseball is becoming younger and more athletic as they emphasize defense to get run through the other guy's 27 outs as fast as possible.
In general, in your opinion, is Major League Baseball changing for the better or worse or neither?
It's changing and changing for the better. First of all, because of ideas like the ones I just mentioned, partly because the three of the five most common surnames in baseball today are Martinez, Rodriguez, and Perez. We've tapped this enormous pool of talent to the south of the United States. It's better today because the venues are better. Since Bud Selig became acting commissioner in 1992, there are 22 new ballparks. None of this nonsense about cookie-cutter circular ballparks made for football and baseball and satisfactory for neither. It used to be you'd look up, you didn't know whether you were in Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Cincinnati, or St. Louis. They all looked alike. Now we have idiosyncratic, wonderfully fan-friendly venues. Now, baseball is doing fine, thanks.
Have you been to the new Yankee Stadium or to Citi Field?
I've been to both.
Opinion about them?
Well, you drive up in front of Yankee Stadium, you get out of your car, you think you're in front of the Commerce Department. It's got this huge slab of granite and doesn't look quite the way I like my ballparks to look. Inside, they're both fine. But to tell you the truth, of all the new ballparks that have come along since Camden Yards began to reinvent the ballpark, I think the one in Pittsburgh is probably the best. It's a little smaller, a little less grand, but more open to the horizon, which baseball should be.
I'm glad you said that about the Commerce Department, because I've said that the new Yankee Stadium is so corporate-looking that the graphics that they use on the scoreboard look like they're right out of a Bank of America annual report.
Exactly.
So I appreciate your analogy. Do you ever take inspiration from the craft of baseball for your work as a political analyst, or are they just too different?
Well, they're similar in this regard. It's baseball is a great game for a democracy because democracy is the politics of the half loaf. No one gets everything they want. You have to split the difference and compromise. And in baseball, every team at spring training knows it's going to win 60 games, and every team knows it's going to lose 60 games. We play the whole season to sort out the middle 42 games. It's a game in which if you win 10 of every 20 games, you're definitionally mediocre. If you win 11 of every 20 games, you win 88 games in a year, and you got a good chance to play in October. So it's a game in which small things add up, accumulation, and that's a rule of life.
By the way, we pulled an old Saturday Night Live clip. I presume you've seen this before. This is Dana Carvey playing you, hosting a baseball-themed quiz show. Listen.
The precarious balance between infield and outfield suggests a perfect symmetry. For $50, identify the effect of that symmetry. Sorry, the answer is the exhilarating tension between being and becoming. Being and becoming.
And we thank the listener who tweeted us that clip about 10 minutes ago. Well, not everybody appreciates the intellectual approach to baseball.
Well, you know, it's an intellectual approach only in the sense that the more you know about baseball, the more you enjoy it. You can enjoy the balletic, extraordinary moves of the NBA without knowing anything about basketball. You can enjoy the controlled violence of the NFL, which is such a spectacle, without knowing a thing about football. In baseball, it helps to know things. That's the only sense in which it's intellectual. I want to avoid this slur of being an intellectual in baseball.
George Will, my guest on WNYC. And let me segue into a little talk about politics this way, because in your new introduction to Men at Work, you write that as a columnist preoccupied with politics and cultural matters, your purpose in writing, more often than not, is less to say what I think about a particular subject than to find out what I think about a particular subject. So for people who may think of you as simply one of the conservatives in our polarized country, have you been discovering what you think in any new ways about some of the issues roiling us all during the Obama administration? Any example come to mind?
Well, Barack Obama is God's gift to columnists because he is a serious man who wants to do things, not just be things. There's no one to be president. He wants to change the country. Now, he wants to change it in ways I regret. But he has resurrected and established a complete continuum with the progressive movement of a century ago, of Herbert Crowley and Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt and all the rest. And in a way, this is our argument today is between two Princetonians, James Madison of the class of 1771 and Woodrow Wilson of a class about 80 years later. What do you think of the restraints on the federal government imposed by or supposedly imposed by Madison's Constitution? I like those limits. The president, like Woodrow Wilson, doesn't. Woodrow Wilson was the first president to criticize the American founding. He said it was all very well for an 18th century rural society, but in a modern industrial society, our government was fundamentally unsuited to the challenges. That's the argument we're having today. It's exhilarating. The president's an engaging adversary, and this is the golden age for columnists.
On one of the issues of the day, the Arizona immigration law, I know you tend to support it, but critics say there are no guidelines here for police to discern who they suspect of being here illegally, and that will lead to constant stopping of Hispanic-looking people, legal or illegal, to ask for their papers. Here is Governor Brewer of Arizona giving a very unsatisfying answer to that question.
I do not know what an illegal immigrant looks like. I can tell you that I think that there are people in Arizona that assume they know what an illegal immigrant looks like. I don't know if they know that for a fact or not. But I know that if AZ Post gets themselves together, works on this law, puts down the description, that the law will be enforced civilly, fairly, and without discriminatory points to it.
So, George Will, what do you think of that clip, and do you think meaningful criteria can be developed?
Sure they can. What the law says is that police officers are going to be required to try to make a reasonable attempt, that's a quote, to determine the status of a person, here's another quote, where reasonable suspicion exists. Now, this is not a new exercise for police, and it's not a new concept in American law. The Fourth Amendment says there shall not be unreasonable searches and seizures. We have, through case law, developed all kinds of restraining and edifying criteria by which police are guided.
So what would be the reasonable criteria to from which to extrapolate suspicion of someone's legal status? It's one thing to, you know, a reasonable criteria for carrying a gun might be if there's a bulge in the pocket or some such thing. What would be reasonable criteria to stop one to look at their status?
Well, if in the investigation of a crime, the police arrive at a place of business and people run out the back door and run away, they might that would be a sign. Second, and there's established law on this. This is not new. We have 40 years of law on this. If in a traffic stop, you ask someone for their papers. Now that, you see, it has been federal law for generations now that immigrants are required to carry their papers. This is not a novel invention in Arizona. The threshold question surely is this. Do you believe the country ought to have open borders, no restrictions at all on immigration? Very few people believe that. So therefore, if you believe there should be immigration laws and therefore presumptively believe they should be enforced, now what exactly is Arizona doing wrong?
You became prominent as a Reagan supporter in the Reagan era. His name is invoked constantly by younger conservative observers. But liberals say they miss the nuances of Reagan, including that he raised taxes after he lowered them to respond to the recession in 1982, and he granted amnesty to immigrants here illegally. But today's conservatives, the liberals say, are more ideologically rigid and less pragmatic. How much do you agree with that?
I don't agree at all. The very fact that Ronald Reagan granted amnesty and nothing happened to prevent serial amnesties is why there is resistance to amnesty again today. In, I think it was 1986, the amnesty that was given was supposed to be followed by the United States, by the federal government, asserting an essential attribute of national sovereignty, which is control of the borders. By its failure to do this, by this striking dereliction of duty under Republicans and Democrats alike, the country has now said, first things first, don't give me this comprehensive immigration reform dream. First things first, you control the borders. After that, we can come to reasonable solutions as to what to do about the 12 million illegal immigrants who are here. But the country now wants the government to follow through on what was promised in 1986.
And one question about Senator Lindsey Graham, if I might, in this context. He's been working with the Democrats on comprehensive immigration reform and cap and trade, but now he's withdrawing support from both just because the Dems have switched the order in which they'll consider those two items. Is he playing a double game? Is he trying to get out of his bipartisanship experiment because it's proving unpopular with his South Carolina constituents? Or what do you think is going on there?
He didn't just learn that it's unpopular with his South Carolina constituents. Various Republican organizations in South Carolina have been censuring him for months now. No, Lindsey Graham has said, I've invested an enormous amount of time and political capital in trying to advance a climate change bill. And now they are doing a bait and switch. They've decided that in order, frankly, this is about getting Harry Reid reelected in Nevada, where he needs to stir up the immigrant population. So they're going to bring this to the floor for political purposes. And Lindsey Graham saying, I'm not going to be party to this. He has taken seriously the president's desire to have a climate change bill and now feels that he's been double-crossed.
30 seconds left. Are you a fan of the biggest conservative media stars these days, Beck, Limbaugh, Hannity, O'Reilly? I don't mean to group them all together, but from your intellectual vantage point, do you think some of them make a mockery of serious conservatism?
Well, you did just lump them all together, but I'm a person of print, and I believe that conservatism is best advanced and explained with the nuances made possible by the written language. And what goes on in a broadcast media is doesn't attract, frankly, that much of my attention.
George Will, his baseball book, Men at Work, The Craft of Baseball, just re-released, originally out 20 years ago. It now has a new introduction. And, George, we really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.